How much time have you spent at home the past few months? I'm guessing a lot considering the pandemic situation. So imagine if you did not have a house to lock down in. Hello, Avani Dias here. And on this episode of Hack, we're meeting the Australians who are still waiting for new houses after losing them in the horrible summer bushfires.
That's the part of the impact of the fire for me, just getting back to the essentials.
Yeah.
A kitchen, toilet, bathroom and shower.
We've got a special report later on the show on where those communities are at 6 months on and the incredible mental toll people are facing after not just the bushfires, but drought and then COVID-19 in such a short time. And later on this episode, we could be jetting from rural Australia to the cities in flying cars soon. There's testing of this new technology happening and we're going to find out how it'll work.
Hack. More than 5 million Victorians will re-enter lockdown from midnight tonight as the Victorian government grapples with a surge in coronavirus cases.
On Triple J.
As Melbourne gets ready to go back into lockdown from midnight, now questions are being asked about whether other parts of the country will end up in the same situation. There have been 3 new COVID-19 cases in the ACT and they're all linked to the Victoria outbreak. And people arriving from Melbourne in New South Wales before the border closed last night, they're meant to go through strict checks for COVID symptoms and to make sure people self-isolate for 2 weeks. But passengers on a flight from Melbourne that landed in Sydney last night were allowed to leave without any of those screenings. Give me a call. Did you arrive from Sydney on one of those flights last night from Melbourne? 1300 055 36. Give me a call.
Hack.
I'm not pleased to be in this set of circumstances. I apologise for the inconvenience, the great challenge that many, many Victorian families are going to have to experience over these next 6 weeks.
But we're all Melburnians now when it comes to the challenges we face. We're all Victorians now because we're all Australians, and that's where the challenge is right now.
This is a really very critical time for us in the New South Wales response.
A Victorian teenager is one of 8 new cases of coronavirus confirmed in New South Wales.
On Triple J.
So health authorities say without a lockdown in Victoria, we could be seeing more than 3,000 coronavirus infections in that state per day by the end of the month. University of Sydney infectious diseases expert Professor Robert Boy is here. Thanks for coming on the show. Let's start with that Jetstar flight that landed from Melbourne to Sydney and passengers were allowed to leave without any screening. It feels eerily similar to the cruise ship Ruby Princess that sort of kicked off the pandemic, right?
Yeah, well, the public health have learned a lot from the Ruby Princess, and I think that the public health specialists and my colleagues will be looking quite carefully even after the fact, and they'll be following these people up, rest assured that they're not going to be let run wild. They'll be checked on.
Should we be worried about that situation and seeing something similar to Victoria and New South Wales?
We should be worried, and the thing that gives me the most concern is the hidden transmissions, the ones that we don't pick up for 2-3 weeks and one case then becomes 50 cases. And so the contact tracing, the testing that's being done is just so important. It's picking things up. It's got the numbers of cases in Queensland and South Australia and Western Australia and New South Wales down to near zero. So it works. We just have to do it better and we have to do it again in Melbourne and wider Victoria.
Should our authorities have known better by this stage? I mean, with Ruby Princess, it was, you know, the early days, we were still getting everything together, but now we've learnt a few months on. Was it acceptable that that Jetstar situation was able to happen?
Well, look, I don't know the full details. I'm of the view that there's probably more happening than we've been told. So I can't give a heavy criticism on something that I don't know the full details about. I'm sorry.
Melbourne and a region north of there are going into lockdown from midnight, and you're saying the rest of the country is now on notice as well. What do you mean by that?
It means that we, as a general population, as Australians, need to respect ourselves and respect our families and communities. We need to pay attention immediately we get a sore throat, a runny nose, a cough, a fever, especially a cough and a fever, and go and get tested. New South Wales has shown very clearly that if you explain very carefully why you're having a test, almost everyone has a test. So this sort of backlash that happened in Victoria was, I believe, because of lack of good communication. And I think the Victorians have changed that. They've learned from that. And the rest of the country is doing very good testing, thousands tested every day, finding only one or two or three. But that's the fruit of our labours. If we keep hard at it, we can keep the numbers right down.
What do you mean about the bad communication in Victoria? What can the other states have learnt from what we've seen in that state?
Well, I think what happened was that some people were approached not as respectfully as they might. They were, maybe weren't spoken to in their own language. They were perhaps confused by what was being told to them. It just wasn't, I think, subtle enough. And I think that's probably one thing that the Victorians have learnt already, that to be more supple, to be more accommodating, to be more careful, you can get the message across, and 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100 even, they'll say, yes, of course I want to get tested. Because, you know, young people, despite the fact that they get the infection more mildly, can occasionally get it more severely. Mm. And what I'd like to emphasise is that they can get it severely without us knowing why. So you may just be a healthy young person in your 20s and 30s, and there's no blood test we can do, there's no examination a doctor can take to show that you're at high risk. You just get sick really quickly and you end up after a week or two in hospital. So, and you know, young people are at risk, but what about their parents and their uncles and their partner's parents?
Yeah, it's obviously, you know, so many people that you could potentially be spreading it to. We are getting absolutely so many people getting in touch on this issue. Sarah's commented on the Triple J Hack Facebook. Let's all get ready for another national lockdown. At this rate, Corona will be back spreading again. Professor, what do you think of that point? Should other states be going into lockdown now to prevent outbreaks like we've been seeing in Melbourne?
Yeah, good question, but we don't need to go that far yet because we're doing such a good job already. What we have to do is maintain the rage, to use an old political saying. We have to maintain the social distancing, the hand washing, the testing, the contact tracing. If we do all those things, we can get away with having groups of people of 10 to 20 and even pubs with 50 to 100. That's all feasible if you maintain that 1.5 metres between each person. Don't get intoxicated, because as soon as you have too much to drink, you'll want to give someone a peck on the cheek or something more.
Yeah, is that a realistic situation, considering pubs are open in basically every other state? And, you know, we've seen authorities in the UK, for example, saying it's not possible for people to remember social distancing when we're drunk. But let's be honest, that's what people are doing at the pub. So, you know, how do you navigate that situation?
What I say very clearly is that we know from decades of research that if you're getting a little bit excited by being intoxicated, provided you're with your partner, it doesn't matter. You don't pass infections backwards and forth very much at all. It's going off with a second partner that's the problem. So if you can maintain a sense of decorum and a bit of control to your partner, you're actually going to do pretty well.
I feel like you're policing everyone's, you know, dating habits now. Well, how do we do that?
If they want to play with fire, they'll get burnt.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, the other situation that we're looking at is the hospitals in Victoria. Authorities are admitting that we will see some deaths over there. Are our hospitals equipped? Obviously, they are much more than they were at the start of the pandemic, but is there enough to prevent as many deaths as possible?
Yes, we've had a 2.5 to 3-fold increase in the number of ventilators available across Australia. We've had a massive increase and a massive change in our supply of high-quality personal protective equipment, ventilators, and all the other paraphernalia that you need in a hospital to save someone's life in intensive care. So we've got enough numbers to deal with many more than we're currently having to deal with. There's not quite 10 yet in intensive care in Victoria, but just a few days ago, there was only one or two.
All right. Professor Robert Boy, thank you so much for joining us on Hack. That professor is from the University of Sydney and he is an infectious diseases expert. A lot of people texting. Someone says Jetstar should face the same fines we've been facing for this breach. Blake's texted in, how does this stuff keep happening? First the Ruby Princess, now this. And another text, I live in Ulladulla on the New South Wales south coast and I'm still seeing Victorian number plates everywhere. It seems like a lot of people do not care. Hack.
Getting back to the essentials. The kitchen, toilet, bathroom and shower. That's the part of the impact of the fire for me.
On Triple J. Last summer, I think every Australian felt some sort of horror seeing large parts of our country being destroyed in the worst bushfires in living memory. We saw people gathering on a beach on the New South Wales south coast because that was the only safety from the fires. There were others pouring the ash of their homes on the steps of Parliament House, calling for climate action. And it feels so long ago because shortly after, coronavirus took all of our attention. But today we have a two-part special on HACC. Our reporter, Shalila Medora, has gone back to those bushfire-ravaged communities and soon we'll see how they're coping on a mental level and if there's enough support. But first, Shalila saw firsthand how so many bushfire survivors are still waiting for new houses 6 months on and in the thick of winter. What you're listening to was nearly 6 months in the making. Mooloowa Bay resident Andy Franz is finally getting a new home.
I'm just going to keep it very user-friendly and basic. Nothing at all whatsoever fancy except maybe cupboards to store things.
Andy lost his home when bushfires tore through the New South Wales south coast on New Year's Eve.
That's the part of the impact of the fire for me. Just getting back to the essentials.
Yeah.
The kitchen, toilet, bathroom and shower, and that's it.
You don't need anything fancy?
Not at all. Not even a lounge, no TV, nothing.
Since January, Andy's been living in a caravan donated by someone from his church. But it was only ever a temporary fix, so the clock is ticking to get Andy into his new place. The South Coast community has really pulled together to help Andy out.
The cost is a major factor, but just really bowled over when I've spoken to friends and they've given me phone numbers and say, oh, come on, we'll get some money together if you need it.
His home is on top of a hill with panoramic views of the ocean. The trees are still scarred and burnt, but there are signs of hope popping up all over the place.
Out in the paddock, all the grass is regrown and, yeah, it's all grown back. The grass, there's tomatoes, it's a whole different landscape.
Andy has lived on this property since 1974, but he's still coming to terms, psychologically, with what remains of the place he's called home since he was a kid.
We were down in the paddock dropping off the tools and it really caught me by surprise. The experience is just still sinking in 6 months after the fire itself.
This summer was dominated by news of bushfires absolutely decimating large parts of the country.
As the year and the decade comes to an end, the country is burning.
The death toll from these South Coast bushfires has risen tonight.
Police confirmed that this morning they found human remains in a small town.
We'd thought we'd seen the worst of it, but today the state's bushfire crisis hit a dangerous and frightening new level.
33 people died and more than 3,000 homes were lost.
This is the black summer of 2019-20 that has proven our national character.
On the south coast, more than 8,000 people have been placed in emergency accommodation since November. More than 60 are living in recovery pods, while others, like Andy Franz when we interviewed him, are still living in tents and caravans. Andy would have been forced to camp out with no running water or electricity if Matt hadn't stepped in.
Matthew Hatcher, I'm the co-founder of Gorilla Roasters and the coordinator of South Coast Donations Logistics.
Matt has no experience in natural disaster recovery or logistics management, like none.
Called a mate, I put it on Facebook and got a mate who had a warehouse and started there.
But when the bushfires hit his hometown of Batemans Bay, he rolled up his sleeves and got to work.
We were on the ground hour one, you know, delivering water and P2 masks to people while their properties are still on fire. And that's something that volunteer groups like Red Cross can't send their guys out to the field and do that.
When Matt started South Coast Donation Logistics, aka SoCo Dolo, he didn't think that he'd still be working on bushfire recovery more than 6 months later. He thought the bigger charities would step in and he could just get back to living his normal life.
We were there for the immediate, and I guess I always thought that we would do a handover to them sort of when they got here, and it just sort of didn't pan out the way that I thought. We just sort of kept growing and had to continue.
There's been a lot of criticism around how long it's taken some of the big charities like Red Cross, Vinnies and the Salvos to distribute the funds they've raised.
Between them, those three charities received $282 million in bushfire donations. But by June, 6 months after the fires, just under half had actually gone into affected communities. That's where Matt steps in. So I'm standing on a site that used to be an old Bunnings. It's by the side of a really busy highway and you can probably hear the traffic go past. But for the last nearly 6 months, it's been a distribution centre to help out bushfire-affected communities.
So this section to start off with is winter clothing, just so people that walk in the door can sort of say, oh, I actually really need that first of all.
SoCo Dolo coordinator and organiser Amy Wise shows me around this massive operation.
So we start with and talk them through and start with the initiatives of saying, are you warm? Do you need blankets? Do you need jumpers, socks? Like, what? Start with the basics and then move to, okay, do you need workwear? Do you need work boots? Do you need tools? Do you need food?
There's everything from lawnmowers and display home kitchens to biscuits and dried pasta. And there's stuff here that makes you realise just how much people have lost.
This one says baby girl, 0 to 1, yeah. So it's baby clothes baby. In that one. Yeah.
Still clothes?
No, the back wall is like toys for kids that were donated. So there was like surfboards, cricket gear, soccer balls.
It's pretty heartbreaking to see how little things make up your life and how quickly they can disappear.
So we're at kind of like the outdoorsy bit by the look of it. So sleeping bags and tents and stuff here. So this was mainly the original donations that came in because initially, you know, first night that it happened, we're like, we need to get people at least under cover.
And when people come in here, it's like no questions asked. If they need something, they get it. Like,
if they need it, they get it, 100%.
Yeah. While Amy's showing me around, someone does show up.
Do you need anything?
I'll have a quick squeeze here in warm jackets and that.
They get other guests too.
It's Oz Harvest in a big thrifty truck coming with supplies.
Hey!
Oh, hey there.
How are ya?
We've seen people break down in tears 5-6 months after, just when we hand them some fresh fruit and veg in particular.
Gabriella Del Pozzo is part of the team who've been making deliveries up and down the coast.
It's like gold dust, even before the fires, the drought had taken it away. So to be able to hand that over and see how much the fruit and veg means in particular, it's a real eye-opener. They're just feeling that they're coming out of a fog, or out of survival mode, really.
And Corona hit shortly after the bushfires and the world spun out of control. So it's understandable that some of these communities are feeling a bit forgotten.
Do you think that the rest of Australia still remembers what's going on here?
I think they remember, but it's sort of crazy times and everyone's in survival mode and they've just got to look after, you know, their family first, and that's completely understandable.
Pack. Triple J.
Amy Wise from South Coast Donations Logistics, ending that story by Shalila Medora. Someone's texted 6 months on and my mum and dad are still living in a caravan. It beats the tent they first had, I suppose. But I wish some of that defence money Scott Morrison just spent went towards people who need help. Another texter, it's not worth simply forgetting the cost of fires during the current crisis and to hold the public figures that have repeatedly failed these communities to account. This is Hack on Triple J and you're listening to our special on how the bushfire hit communities are coping 6 months on, and many were battling a massive drought before the fires, and since then, like all of us, they've been facing the pandemic and all that comes with that. Some people are now warning the next big disaster will be an increase in suicides and mental illness in those areas. Shalila Medora looks at what's being done to help. And just a warning, this story discusses mental health and suicide.
The sky was red, absolutely brilliant red. And there was a horrific noise. It was like a railway train was coming, a locomotive.
Andrew Hayden is a farmer and developer and head of the Cobargo Business Tourism Association. He's talking to me on a scratchy mobile phone line from his property in Cobargo in southeast New South Wales.
I went inside to my partner at the time and said, the sun's got up on the wrong side of the world today. And it was a very, very scary situation.
The New Year's Eve fire ripped through Cobargo and destroyed a number of Andrew's properties.
It was pretty, you know, pretty traumatic times for a lot of people.
Andrew just kicked into gear and put all his efforts into rebuilding. He hasn't really had time to process the trauma of what he lived through.
I haven't had a day off in over 6 months. I only believe I went from survival stage to recovery stage about 2 weeks ago.
While there were mental health support services in the early days, COVID-19 changed all that.
If somebody was feeling really bad, you could always give them a hug, console them, you could shake their hands and that sort of stuff. You know, that was almost outlawed. People weren't communicating, there was this isolation.
Andrew knows of a few people who've died by suicide, and he's really worried that we're going to see more. It's hard to hear him properly here. He gets choked up when he's talking to me.
That's the hard thing, hard to take. They get through most of the trauma, the initial trauma, and then they don't survive. So that's what it gets to.
The South Coast region of New South Wales has a population that's already at risk of suicide. Their rates are higher than other parts of the country. But Alison Bradley from Coordinaire, the organisation that delivers mental health services through the primary health network in that region, says it's just too early to know if that's going to get worse.
What we're hearing on the ground anecdotally is that people are talking about an increase in suicide deaths, but we are unable to confirm this because the data that we get is usually a couple of years down the track. But again, anecdotally, when we go and explore that a bit further on the ground, that is not actually the case.
Alison says there hasn't been an increase in people seeking mental health support, but that could change as the shock wears off and trauma sets in.
It can come at any time. It can come 6 months down the track or even a couple of years down the track. And often people don't even recognise that it started with the bushfires in the first place.
When we then have COVID come into the middle of that and disrupt that process, I think it's something that we have to be really, really alert to a possibly, you know, a second disaster, I guess.
Stephanie Robinson from Lifeline in the central west of New South Wales was part of the initial mental health response in places like Cobargo. Her team had to pull out when COVID hit.
I know myself, having been down there for nearly 10 weeks, driving home, sort of wiping away tears, feeling like we're leaving a job half done.
That's something Matthew Hatcher from South Coast Donation Logistics recognised early on too.
I smell smoke and I think of the fires. I've had people in my car, we're driving and they see smoke and they go, oh, can we not go that way?
He noticed that when he was dropping off donations, people weren't doing so well in processing the trauma from the fires. He decided to do something about it.
Shipping container doors.
Yeah, your normal
doors.
Shipping container doors. Yep. Around the front, we've got the large window office that opens up. The opposite end, it does make it quite versatile, and the fact that we can just pick it up and move it anywhere was always the thinking behind it as well.
One of the biggest problems was that there wasn't a neutral space for people to talk to counsellors like Stephanie when they came to town. So he created one.
This is all fitted out electronically.
Yeah, all electrics are, so 32 amps, so if we want to put a large coffee machine in here at some point. And use it.
Matt reached out to graphic design company Canva and raised $32,000 to get a brand new fully insulated shipping container that can be used as a mental health hub.
I had the idea that possibly we'd get some graffiti artists on the outside and it could maybe one day be a pop-up cafe in town so that it keeps the legacy of what it is. So it's a positive reminder of the fires.
If you're thinking to yourself, why is it up to Matt to fundraise for something so crucial? You're not alone. I had the opportunity to ask that question to Andrew Constance, the state MP for the region.
Why was it up to a charity group to raise funds for a facility like this?
I'd be buggered if I know. I'm hopeful now, having met with the Red Cross, that they are now going to start to personalise their approach.
It's not just those big charities, though. I mean, you're a Member of Parliament. We acknowledge that this region was already vulnerable to mental health concerns. Should there have been a little bit of foresight in this space?
It is very much. It's been highlighted, that inadequacy, because of the fires.
Andrew Constance says the lack of mental health professionals on the ground is something that the state and federal governments need to work on. And he's got a personal stake in this. He struggled as a result of the bushfires too.
Well, I had counselling twice. It's probably fair to say I still need some more.
Alison Bradley says there's a valid reason to worry about the cumulative effect of bushfire, drought and now the pandemic. But she says service providers like hers are aware of it, and that means they can direct resources to stop the next big disaster from striking.
A lot of those things piled up on the South Coast community possibly could lead to poorer mental wellbeing, but we're trying to put everything possible in place to support the community.
Hack Triple J. Shalala Modora with that story. And if it raised any issues for you, there's always help available. You can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. And if you're listening from those South Coast communities, Headspace is also available to you. Chris from Melbourne's texted, the fact nothing is happening sucks, and the fact the federal government isn't pushing this rebuilding work is such a shame.
Hack. This is big enough that there would be two passengers inside this drone here. So this could well be the future of transportation.
On Triple J.
When you think of what the future looks like, one of the first things that always pops into mind is flying cars. It's just like the Jetsons, or in Star Wars, I guess, but they're probably more spaceships in that situation. But say you're living in Mount Isa near Queensland's border with the Northern Territory, and you're like, I want to head to dinner in Brisbane. So you jump in your flying car and shoot over. So the technology to make that exact scenario a thing is being tested in regional New South Wales. If you live in a regional or rural area with no airport, would this help? Call me 1300 055 36. Aerospace company AMSL Aero is doing this testing and developing the technology. Founder Andrew Moore is here. Thanks for joining us. I'm wondering what kind of car you drive and what made you get into flying cars, because you obviously want an upgrade.
Well, so for a very long time, I drove lots of bombs, but I'm happy to say I now have a Tesla Model 3, which sounds a little bit pretentious. Nice. But look, the future is electric, and flying cars will exist soon. We are building and testing them, and they will also be electric.
So how could these cars actually work?
Well, so they're more like a plane that takes off and lands vertically. So they will take off and land a bit like a helicopter, but they'll be quieter and cheaper to operate. And they'll take off from, you know, roughly a tennis court size clearing, and then rapidly transition and fly, you know, at speeds much faster than helicopters today.
And you'd obviously need an upgraded license, right? I mean, I couldn't just step into one of those and start driving them.
So in the early years, it will need a pilot, and that person will need to have a pilot's license. But we see very soon that, like ride shares that are being, you know, that are in existence in most of our cities today, we would see this being used in a rideshare-like environment. So you wouldn't need a license, you just need an app.
Yeah, right. And the big question is, are they safe?
So aircraft and airliners are the safest form of transport by orders of magnitude in the world today. So these things will be the same level of safety as airliners. So it's actually going to be safer than walking down the street.
Heaps of people texting in. Someone says, I build my own drones for drone racing, but there's no way you'd find me putting myself in one. So you're testing this technology now in far west New South Wales. What exactly are you going through in that area?
Well, so Narromine, which is where we're setting up a facility, is an awesome place for test flying. And the early stages of test flying are tuning various parameters within flight control systems. And then over time, that evolves into safety testing that's part of the certification process.
And so, when could we actually see flying cars become a reality? Because it does feel still like there's a lot of work to be done.
So there are multiple companies flying similar types of technology around the world. We are working towards being able to sell these commercially in 2023. So it's not that far away. It's a lot of work for me and my team, but yeah, it's not that far away at all.
Hack on Triple J.
That's all we've got time for on this episode. Remember, you can always subscribe to the Hack podcast every weekday. We bring you up to speed on everything going on around the world and the stuff that matters to young people. So hit that button wherever you get your podcasts. See ya.